Hello. In the last couple of audio snippets, we have been talking about the military and a fundamental problem with it that has that was manifested, you could say, in through the events that happened in the American Civil War. And I thought that we had already basically finished that topic and that we would be moving on to something else, but the day after the last after the recording of the last audio snippet, I ran into something that drew my attention, and I realized that it was not a coincidence, and that I needed to share this in this next audio snippet as a kind of final touch or final a point related to what we've been talking about regarding the American military. And I know that I was made to run into this that I'm about to share with you for a purpose so that I could share it this time in this audio snippet. And you might think that the topic is completely off topic. We've been talking about Black America, and we've kind of apparently digressed a little bit into the military, and now we're going to apparently be digressing even further, but it's all related, and I hope you that you see that everything is connected. And what I'm going to talk about, oddly enough, is football. And when I say football, I'm referring to what in America is called is known as soccer. But everywhere else on earth, it's called football, with good reason, because you play it by kicking the ball with your foot, as opposed to American football, which is more of a combination of running and holding the ball with your hands and passing it with your hands and catching it with your hands and so forth. So I generally prefer the term football, unless I'm talking to a purely American audience that will have no clue what I'm talking about, unless I say the word soccer. But I hope you don't mind. I'll be using the word football to refer to what everybody else on earth calls football. And what I'm going to talk about is the 1978 World Cup, a little bit, but more specifically, the Argentinian national team. That was the team that won the World Cup. In 1978, the World Cup was hosted by Argentina, and Argentina, the host, ended up winning the World Championship that year. And that World Cup, personally to me, is very meaningful because it was the first World Cup that I had ever watched as a kid. I was way too young for the 1974 World Cup that was played in Germany, so I had no consciousness of the World Cup much, or football per se. So the 1978 World Cup was the first World Cup that I, as a kid, watched with any sort of interest or with any sort of awareness of what was going on. And I remember that World Cup. I remember watching the final that was Argentina against Holland, and Argentina ended up winning. I was rooting for Holland at that time as a kid. I supported Holland, but Argentina won. And the thing with Argentina winning that World Cup was that 4 years earlier in '74, the World Cup that was played in Germany or West Germany at that time, because there was a division there. But let's just say Germany. The '74 World Cup that was played in Germany was won by Germany, hosted in Germany and won by Germany, interestingly enough. And in that World Cup, the world saw the rise of a team called that people would call the Mechanical Orange. It was the team of Holland or the Netherlands, but I prefer to say Holland. I don't know why, it just feels better to say Holland than the Netherlands, maybe because it's shorter. But the thing is that in 1974, this team came up called the Holland national team that impacted the world with a completely different style of play that was called total football. And basically, it was a very dynamic system where everybody went on the attack and everybody seemed to defend. It was like very fluid. It was not static like most previous playing schemes that had been used up until then. This team had all the players running up and down like crazy, defenders going up to attack and forwards coming back to defend constantly in this fluid motion. And they were led by this great player called Johan Cruyff. And they stunned the world. They made it out of nowhere to the final game against the host, Germany. But they ended up losing it. If I remember correctly, Holland scored first. So they went ahead. And then Germany tied and then went on to win. I think it was 2-1. I could be wrong. I'm not too clear on that. But the thing is that Germany won. The thing is, during that World Cup, Holland played Argentina in a game. And if I'm not mistaken, Argentina got trounced 4-0 by Holland. They got completely humiliated. And Argentina had, even though it had never won the World Cup, it was always considered one of the top teams in the world, in a sense, because they actually made it to the final of the World Cup in the first World Cup ever played. That was played in Uruguay in 1930. They made it to the final and lost. But they had never been able to kind of get over the hump, but they had a strong football tradition. They were considered a pretty good, solid team, internationally speaking. But in that World Cup in 1974, they looked awful. I mean, they got really dominated by the Dutch team. And they got, if I could be wrong with this, but if I'm not mistaken, they got bounced off the World Cup in the first round. So they really did nothing, and it was a national embarrassment because, you know, Argentina, kind of like Brazil, you know, lives and breathes football. So it was a pretty shameful moment for the whole country and the team. Now, the thing is that a few years before that, going back 4 years to 1970 when the World Cup was played in Mexico, there was a guy called Cesar Luis Menotti, a former Argentinian football player who became coach. In 1970, he decided to travel to Mexico to watch the World Cup. I'm not sure why, but he chose to travel to Mexico, and he watched. He got to watch Brazil play. And 1970 was the World Cup when Pelé, many of you may have heard of him, even if you're not football fans. That was the World Cup when where Pelé won his third and final World Cup, and Brazil became the first team ever to win three World Cups. And that was important because there was this thing where it had been agreed upon from I don't know how long ago that the first team who won the World Cup three times would get to keep the trophy, you know, the actual, you know, World Cup, you know, or the trophy, the Jules Rimet trophy. And that's why there was a certain race, you could say, to get to the third World Cup. And Brazil made it first in 1970. And if you have ever watched reels of that World Cup, you will see how beautiful Brazil played. I mean, they had players like Jairzinho and Gerson and Tostão and Rivelinho, along with Pelé and Carlos Alberto. It was a beautiful, beautiful team. And they played beautiful ball and they made it to the finals and they beat Italy, of all teams, a powerful Italian team. And they crushed them in the finals 4-1. That's how dominant that Brazilian team was. And Menotti got to watch that team, and he was enthralled by the beauty of the game. And he took that message home back to Argentina, because in Argentina in the late 60s and into the early 70s, a certain style of football became dominant. And it was because there was this coach, I don't remember his name right now, it starts with a Z, But this coach was the coach of a team in Argentina called Estudiantes, which is Spanish for students. So he was the coach of Estudiantes, and apparently Estudiantes was very became very successful. And it was successful through this style promoted by this coach. And it was a very inelegant style. It was a very pragmatic style, focused on results, focused on winning, but not on the beauty of the game. So it was very rough. It was very winning at all costs. It was all through effort and sacrifice and playing rough and so forth. And because he happened to be successful with this style, it's as if all of Argentina decided to play that way, and they started. It became the style of football that Argentina would play, and that's the style that they took to Germany in 1974. And when they took that style, it was no grace, no beauty, just just hard-nosed and rough and tough, and through just human physical effort, trying to win at all costs. When that style faced up against the total football, the mechanical orange of Holland, they just didn't know what to do. They just got totally dominated. But the thing is that 1 year prior to the 74 World Cup, this Menotti guy got to be the coach of a team in Argentina called Huracán. It starts with an H, but the H is silent in Spanish. So you could say it's Huracan, which would be Spanish for hurricane. I don't know if they were called Hurricane because they were from a city called Hurricane, or that was just the name they gave themselves. I have no idea. But the thing is, this team called Huracan was coached by Menotti in '73. And they dominated the Argentinian football that year, and they dominated because Menotti, having had that experience in 1970 of watching Brazil and that beautiful Jogo Bonito, that beautiful playing style of Brazil, having watched that, he brought it to Argentina, and he kind of bred it into his team in Huracán. And he totally transformed their playing style, and they were so they were so delightful and elegant in their style that there were even a few times where the opposing fans would applaud them. And there was an example of there was one game where they beat a team called Rosario Central, one of the big teams in Argentina. They beat them 5-0. And at the end of the game, the fans of Rosario Central started cheering and applauding Huracán just because they admired the beauty of the game of the football style they had just witnessed, even though it led to their own home team losing so badly. There was a forward called Carlos Babington. He's kind of well known in Argentinian football. And he once said that there were I'm just quoting here. He said there were gambetas, one touch moves, nutmegs, sombreros, one twos, overlaps, unquote, in the style of Huracán. And gambeta is a term that's used in Argentina to refer to when you have the ball and you fake like you're going one way. But you quickly change direction and go the opposite way to kind of fool the defender. That's a gambetta, I think. And a one-touch move, I guess, is basically when you receive the ball and you just pass it on one touch. You don't dribble it, you just pass it on, like a one-touch pass. I don't know what a nutmeg is. Sombrero is when you lob the ball over the defender that's in front of you and catch the ball behind him and keep going. It's like that's a sombrero. And 1-2, I guess, it's like when you pass the ball, you give it to some other guy, the other guy gives it back to you immediately, back and forth as you're going forward. It's very beautiful when you see two players do that, and an overlap. I have no idea what that is, but what I'm trying to say is that Menotti taught the players to motivated them to be creative, to enjoy the game, and to play with beauty and joy. So Oricon, focused on the fineries of football, on skill, on beautiful passing, and being forward thinking in the sense of, going forward, attacking style, not just going back and defending. And all that style went against the prevailing methodology that was, ruling Argentinian football at the time. And it got to be called anti-football because it was like the opposite of good football. Menotti actually preferred the term right-wing football. That's what he called it. Instead of anti-football, he called it right-wing football because he viewed it as a struggle and sacrifice. And he once said, quote, right-wing football wants us to believe that life is a struggle. It demands sacrifices. We have to become steel and win by any methods. So it's a style that says, no, if you didn't win, it's because you didn't run fast enough. It's because you didn't try hard enough. It's because you didn't sweat enough. It's because you didn't want the win enough or want it more than the other team. So it's all effort and you giving of yourself in this sacrifice and it's not how beautiful you play. It's like winning at all costs. If you have to foul that guy, you foul him. You do what you have to do in order to win. That's right-wing football, and it's interesting that he called it that way. And that kind of illustrates a certain element of this whole thing, that right-wing football that he's talking about is promoted by a combination of two personalities. We've talked about the five personalities personality components that form anyone's personality. We've said there's judge, there's visionary, there's conqueror, there's server, and there's organizer. Those are the five traits or personality traits that you can have. You can have one of them or a combination of them, and most of us are born with at least one of those, if not more, as part of our factory settings. We come with those by default, and we may absorb other traits that we were not born with, maybe through observation or whatever, from other people. Or we learn to embrace a trait we were not born with, but we were born with at least one. A lot of people have two, and a few people have all five of them, out of the factory, factory settings. And the two personalities that form what Menotti was calling right-wing football would be the judge personality and the organizer personality, but in a distorted way. So those two, when you combine them and they are distorted, turn into right-wing football. The judge is always critical. It's always saying, no, you didn't do enough. You didn't do enough. You didn't do enough. And the organizer is the organizer is always aiming for a goal. We care for the goal. We don't care how we do it. We just care for the goal. Organizers are goal-oriented. It's always work within the system. You do what you're told, and you follow the orders of the superiors right above you, and everything is going to be okay. And that's what right-wing football was about. In the right-wing football, as Menotti would call it, you had to suppress your individuality. You couldn't be yourself anymore. You just had to be one cog in this machinery and just obey and follow the exact orders of your superiors. And that was important because it was if you had to sacrifice, it's interesting that Menotti would say these things, the word sacrifice. It's like you had to sacrifice your individuality in order to win the game for the team. It's like you die to your... to yourself, to who you are, what you are, in order to produce a positive result, to win the game. but it's that judge and organizer kind of working in a negative way. And those two, when they get together, they are very, very antithetical, if that's the correct word, against the visionary personality. In other words, when a judge and organizer mentality take hold, but they take hold in a corrupted way, they become very, very antagonistic towards people who rise up with a visionary personality. They suppress it and they try to destroy it very quickly. So anyone who doesn't go by the system is quickly suppressed, attacked, and destroyed. And you can see it, like, even nowadays with the current, you know, what happened with the virus and all that. There was the judge and organizer. People who live by the organizer personality are always very hierarchical. It's like, you do what the authorities say you do, because that's why they are authorities. That's why they are the experts. That's why they have the title, the diploma, or whatever. And you do what the experts tell you to do. And that's why all these people idiotically followed all these guidelines that were completely superstitious, unscientific. And anyone who dared to question any of that, anyone who was willing to be a visionary, who was not just willing to be a sheep and follow, but was willing to question and analyze and think on his or her own, was, you know, quickly attacked and demonized, and is still being demonized and suppressed. So that's kind of like the dynamic that was going on there. And I remember years ago, I forget how long ago, but it was many years ago, that I saw this documentary about Menotti. I think it was it was a long time ago. I think Reagan was president. But I saw this documentary about this guy, and I was kind of fascinated by it. Because it was a whole show about him and his playing philosophy, and that's exactly what it was, philosophy. Because he had these he would make these statements that sounded very philosophical about how to play the game, and I don't remember the exact quotes because that was so long ago, but I was kind of like fascinated by, oh wow, this guy's not just a coach, you know, just doing X's and O's and things like that. He is a thinker who sees the game as a philosophy, and he would explain like rules, but they were not just philosophy in a very kind of ethereal, impractical way. It was philosophy. You sounded like a philosopher, but the philosophy statements he would make had a very practical application when you got down to it, but they were embedded in a philosophy, an idea. He was very philosophical, so he was a very visionary in his personality. And he once said, and I'm quoting what he said here. I'm reading this. It says he once said, "I maintain that a team is above all an idea. And more than an idea, it's a commitment. And more than a commitment, it's the clear convictions that a coach must transmit to his players to defend that idea. So my concern is that we coaches don't arrogate to ourselves the right to remove from the spectacle the synonym of festival in favor of a philosophical reading that cannot be sustained, which is to avoid taking risks." And in football, there are risks, because the only way you can avoid taking risks in any game is by not playing. So, and this statement caught my attention, and I said, wow, this statement basically summarizes everything we were trying to say about the military. So I'm going to go through it again. He said, "I maintain that a team is above all an idea." So in other words, a team revolves around an idea. And I would change the word a bit. I'd call it an ideal. I would add an L at the end. So it's an ideal. Like, okay, we are here for a purpose, to achieve an ideal. That's what forms the team. If you don't have an ideal, there is no team. And he said, more than an ideal, idea or an ideal, as I would say it, it's a commitment. So he said, so you have an ideal, and around that ideal, a group of people form and make a commitment to that ideal. But it's a commitment that they make voluntarily. They say, okay, I choose to commit myself to that ideal. And then he said, and more than a commitment, it's the clear convictions that a coach must transmit to his players to defend that idea. In other words, he's saying, I as a coach have a responsibility of teaching, of explaining the ideal or the idea to the team players so that they not only, just play on the team, they develop a personal conviction in favor of that idea. And then they are playing not because they're forced to play, it's because they are convinced that that is the way to play, or that's what we're playing for. And that's the coach's responsibility to transmit that that idea so that the players develop a personal conviction in favor of that idea, and that binds the commitment to the idea. And then you have a true team. And in a sense, you kind of see that in a very distorted way with the military currently. But the ideal is, unfortunately, an ideal that is self-validating in a very weird sense. In other words, the ideal that around which the military, operates as a, quote, team, is the ideal that we are here to obey our superiors and to do what the country, and that's always a very kind of vague thing, what the country tells us to do. And that translated in practicality is what our superiors tell us to do. So they're not there so much for a concept. It's like the concept is self-validating. The team, it's like, I exist to be faithful to the team, and that's the ideal. I hope I'm making sense. It's an ideal that is empty because it doesn't really stand for anything. I can apply that concept to any military. So if I'm in the Soviet military, back in the old Soviet days of the Soviet Union, then I am in the military. I'm here to be part of the team where our ideal is to defend the interests of our country, which is the Soviet Union. So by being part of the Soviet Union army, you are promoting the ideals of the Soviet communism, communists. And then you can translate that concept to Germany, Nazi Germany. If you were part of the Nazi army, you were there to do what your country was telling you to do, which in this case was what Hitler was telling you to do. So you are there to defend Nazism and left-wing fascism. Remember, Hitler was a left-wing fascist. He was a socialist. People always forget that. He was a stupid socialist. He was not a right-wing conservative. He was a socialist. You stupid liberal. To this day, people don't seem to get that. Nazi comes from National Socialist Party. It's a short, an abbreviation of National Socialist in German. It's the National Socialist Party, not the National Conservative Party. So he was a left-wing fascist. Fascism is inherently left-wing. There is no right-wing fascism. I'm sorry to say, there isn't. There is some sort of right-wing kind of dictatorship, but that's not fascism. But that's a story for another audio snippet. The thing is that what we were saying is that if the concept around or the idea around which armies form themselves is empty. It's like saying, I'm here to serve the team. That's the idea that binds the team together in the military. And you apply that concept to them, any military in the world. So you end up defending and upholding anything. If you're in the Soviet army, you're defending communism. If you're in the Nazi army, you're defending left-wing fascism. If you are in Uganda, you're maybe defending some crazy dictator. And I hope you see what I mean. It's an empty idea. And that is, for example, what made the war in Iraq and Afghanistan kind of different from other wars, that recent wars we've been in, because when people joined the army after 9/11, they didn't do it because I want to be part of a team and whatever the team tells me to do, I'm going to do it because I'm a team player. No, they joined the army or the military because they saw what happened to the Twin Towers. And when they saw what happened to the Twin Towers, they said, how the hell do these sons of bitches dare to attack our country like that? We're going to kick butt, and I'm going to join the military and go kick some Muslim butt. And that's what we had to do. Sorry, that doesn't sound politically correct, but that is the reality. So they joined the military with this conviction that we were going to fight the Muslim terrorists and hunt them down and defeat them and tear down their nests and tear down all these hotbeds of radical terrorism. That's what Saddam Hussein was maintaining in that land or enabling. But we don't want to get into the details of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, but the basic idea I'm trying to say is people joined the military with a conviction, with a personal conviction. And many of them fought around that ideal. Now, the wars were bungled because of how they were managed by Bush, but that's a different story. But that is the concept that militaries need to be built around. It's around an ideal. And that's what was missing in Vietnam. In Vietnam, people were drafted into the military. They were forced into this team. And once they were in the team, what was the ideal of the team? Just do what you're told. You know, you have to go to a jungle and do this, you go do it. Like, for example, I heard that there was a, I forget the name of the of this covert team that was, they were training these people to do covert operations, and they would send them into Cambodia or Laos, I forget which of the two, you know, a neighbor with Vietnam. Because what would happen is the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, like cowards, they would go do an attack against the Americans or the South Vietnamese, and then retreat into the border, you know, the neighboring country. And once they went into the neighbor country, because the neighboring country was neutral, then the Americans or the South Vietnamese could not go chasing them in, because that would be like an invasion. But so it's ironically, it's North Vietnamese and Viet Cong were invading that place, but that was okay. But the Americans and the South Vietnamese could not go in. The thing is to kind of get around that. I don't know if it was Nixon or who in the world it was, decided it's a great idea if we create this covert team and send them into Cambodia or Laos, whichever it was, or both maybe, to go find where the ammunitions are and where these people are hiding, where are their nests in those countries, and so that we can then go and destroy them, maybe by air or do whatever, but we need intelligence on where these people are, where their ammunitions are stored and where they are coming from, etc. So they would send them in, and the thing that they would tell them was, if you get caught, you have to know that the American Army government is going to deny you and say we have nothing to do with you. We have nothing to do with these operations, because they didn't want to have an international incident and have a problem where why are the Americans violating the neutrality of Laos and Cambodia and so forth. So they were effectively saying to these guys, you're on your own. If they catch you, we're not gonna fight for you. We're gonna pretend like, you know, we have no idea what the hell you're doing there. And we didn't send you. Imagine that. And these people were going to do that because that's what they were being told. And they were being told beforehand, we're not going to defend you if they catch you. What I'm trying to say is that there's this atmosphere in the military where people were there just because they were supposed to be there and they were supposed to follow orders. They never understood. If you ask most veterans, I would assure you that most of them didn't have a clear understanding of why they were there. Because, to be frank, not even Nixon or Johnson knew why we were there. They knew it was to fight. It was because we didn't want another domino to fall. It was all like this this military game strategy with the Soviet Union. And that was the gist of it. But neither Johnson nor Nixon, and I'm not including Kennedy because Kennedy was a little bit different. If Kennedy had lived, I think the Vietnam War would have been different because he was there. He did have a concept of why we were there. But the thing is that neither Johnson nor Nixon understood that we were there for the sake of the South Vietnamese people. We were there just like we were in South Korea when America fought the Korean War, and we saved Korea from becoming a communist, completely communist peninsula. I mean, South Korea is prosperous and a wealthy and free economy and society because of the Korean War. Americans fought so that the South Korean people could be free. It was not just a matter of a domino falling or anything to that effect. It was because there were people there that were being attacked whose liberty was on the verge of being destroyed. And the same thing was happening in South Vietnam. But it was much more complex in Vietnam than it was in Korea, but that's not the point we want to get into. The idea is that we didn't understand why we were there. The soldiers didn't understand. So they were fighting just because they were being told to fight. They would be told, go shoot someone, go shoot these people here, or do this, do that, do the other. And they were just doing it. It was not because of their own personal conviction. Some of them might have had it, but most didn't have it. And that's what created a lot of the trauma. They were not psychologically ready for the psychological warfare of all the weird things that are embedded in Southeast Asia, Southeast Asia, that Indochina part of the world has a lot of things going on there, very nasty things. And if you weren't there out of conviction, you were basically like meat to the lions and tigers that kind of dominate that area, kind of the atmosphere of that part of the world. But so what we're trying to say is that's how the military should be, like what this Minotti guy was saying, it's you're a team. More than a team, it's an idea. And more than an idea, it's a commitment. And more than a commitment, it's the clear convictions that the coach or the people who are in a position of authority must transmit to the team members so that they can understand why the idea is important, so that they can defend the idea and fight for it. And that's the responsibility. It's not that you don't just say, you do what you're told, soldier. And that's the end of it. If I tell you to do to jump up and down 100 times, you do it. Why? Because I told you to. That's the only reason you need to have. If you impart that mentality, then you're not transmitting the ideal. Why are we here? We're here to fight communism. We're here to do this. We're here to do that. We're here to do whatever needs to be done. And then have people have a certain freedom to be themselves and maybe go off script. And that's what Minotti was allowing his players. Say, you just be free to create. And these Argentinian players started creating. And that's why he became successful. And he brought this attitude into 1978. He became the coach of the Argentinian national team in 78. And I know the 78 World Cup has a lot of controversies because there was a dictatorship in Argentina, and a lot of people say Argentina was given the World Cup because of the pressure of the dictators. That's a long story, but I do believe that if you look at how at the games and things like that in more detail, you can see that Argentina won because they were the team that had to win. Not just because the dictators were threatening the other teams or anything like that in Argentina. It was because they really were the better team. a little bit better than Holland, even though I was rooting for Holland, you know, at that time in watching my first World Cup, they were my team. And the thing is that they were able to win. And in that finals, they faced Holland again. So it's interesting, Holland played in 74 against Germany when Germany was hosting the World Cup. Then they made it to the final game again in 78 against Argentina, where in Argentina. So they made it to the final game twice, and both times they had to play the host country, which is kind of horrible because you're in their country, you know, the whole crowd is cheering for the other team and the atmosphere is very tense and so forth. So Holland, you know, Argentina scored first. They had a player called Mario Alberto Kempes, a guy with the long hair. Every time he'd score, he would just run like a gazelle to celebrate with his arms open like an airplane. But he was not doing the airplane like in a mocking way, like the way they do now. He was just happy. So he just like a bird extending his wings and just flying and enjoying the goal. Very, very humble player, very humble man. They called him the Matador, Mario Alberto Kempes. He scored the first goal. Argentina went up 1-0. And Holland scored like 8 minutes before the end of the game. And it was 1-1. And I remember at the end of the game, in the 90th minute, Holland, there was a Dutch player who passed the ball to this guy in the box, his, you know, fellow player. And the guy went past the defender and shot at the goal, at the Argentinian goal. And the goal and the ball hit the left left goal post from his angle, the left goal post, and bounced off, and you could hear the whole crowd in the stadium go, you know, like this gasping, because they thought that, you know, if that ball had gone in, the game would have been over, and Holland would have been the world champion, but it didn't. And I remember watching it, and I said, oh my goodness, we could have won, and then they went into overtime, and Argentina scored 2 goals in overtime. Mario Alberto Kempes scored again, and then there was a guy called Bertoni who scored again, and they won 3-1, and so they made it very clear, we are the champions, and it was because of this guy Menotti who transformed them. He said, you have to take risks. He said, we have to get away from the idea, an idea that cannot be sustained, which is to avoid taking risks. And that's the thing. And you can see that in all aspects. Like, oh, if you let anyone, you know, be creative, then it's going to be chaos. And they're going to do their thing. And the team is going to fall apart and all that. So you don't take risks. So no one goes off script. Everybody does what they're told and we'll be okay. Don't let people get too creative. And you see that in the American, in the whole world, I guess, but let's talk specifically about the American church, the Christian church. They don't like people to be creative spiritually on their own. Everybody has to just follow the script. You do what the pastor tells you to do, what your congregation or your denomination tells you to do. You don't have to worry. You know, yeah, don't read your Bible on your own. You know, just go to church and let them feed you what they think is the truth, but don't think on your own, because if you start thinking on your own and so forth, then you're going to get these crazy ideas, and you're going to start following these, you know, sects or, you know, kind of heresies, and it's going to fall apart. So no. Everybody is top down, very controlled, and you see that in the military. You see that in all forms of government, and we saw it in a very vast scale with the virus. You know, you don't take risks. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has declared that if you stand 6 feet apart, then the risk is minimized, and you have to wear a mask on you. But they don't. It doesn't matter. The mask, the hole is 20 to 50 times larger than the virus particle. It doesn't matter that studies, even at the beginning of the whole thing, published in the New England Journal of Medicine were saying that the masks are not effective against flu-like viruses. Studies going back 12 years, always consistently saying masks are not effective against this type of virus. But no, 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 we don't care. We just do what we're told. And why 6 feet? You know, if it's 5 feet and 11 inches, do I get sick? Is it five? Who came up with 6 feet? You know, and as I always joke, in Europe it was 2 meters, but 2 meters is a little over 6 feet. So what is it with the virus in Europe that it doesn't jump into you and kill you if you're 2 meters away in Europe? But in America it's only 6 feet. So in Europe the virus seems to be a little kind of like more athletic and making taller leaps than in America. These artificial, you know, things. And even the New England Journal of Medicine published an article saying that you have to be in close proximity within less than or approximately 6 feet of a person who is symptomatic for 20 to 30 minutes to have a strong probability of getting infected. So, you know, but that was at the very beginning when it was not politicized. Afterwards, then they all started just singing the same song and humming the same tune and saying the same thing, all the journals and everybody. But it was all in this promotion of safety, safety, safety. Don't take risks. Why are you going to take a risk? Just wear the stupid mask. If it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. But, you know, it's better than nothing. You know, this risk. Now, why are you going to be that close? Yeah, the likelihood of you getting sick by being five feet away from someone, you know, is very low. But why take the risk? So no risk taking. And everybody just playing it safe. What does the CDC say? If the CDC says we can take our masks off, then we can take our masks off. If they say keep them on, then you keep them on. Sometimes they say wear two. Sometimes they say you know, wear three masks, and so forth. And they, you know, this thing, because I am focused on not taking risks or not thinking on my own, and that's why. You know, and that was the part of the problem in the military in the Civil War, when they were told, when the Emancipation Proclamation came out and they understood we're here to free the slaves, then they began to gather around an ideal and they became committed to it. And they didn't need much impartation to establish a clear conviction in favor of that ideal. And then they said, we're going to go kick some Southern white slave owner butt. And that's what they went to do. And that's when the war completely got turned around. And that's when the Union Army got galvanized, when it stopped being this just very conservative, holding the fort type of organization where everybody just did what they're told. And that's when the loose cannons got let loose. People like Grant. Grant was having trouble with this guy that we were mentioning, as you may recall, Henry Halleck, because it's like Henry Halleck didn't like Grant because Grant just was different. Henry Halleck replaced a guy called Fremont that we mentioned before, as you may recall, who had this crazy idea, let's start promoting the emancipation of slaves as we in the territories we hold. And Lincoln said, how dare you think like that without my authorization? And he threw him out. Then 2 years later, he's doing exactly what Fremont was doing. But he did it in a very disguised way and half-hearted and insincere way. But even so, it worked. And you had another guy called Sherman, who was another loose cannon. And the guy, once Lincoln just let loose, he just stopped interfering and just let them be. And let Grant, put Grant in the position of Union commander, and Grant then allowed Sherman to be free, then Sherman just went on a rampage. And my goodness, we all know what happened. And that's when the war was won. So I hope all of this is making sense, and how it relates, how this guy Menotti's brilliance in changing the way Argentina played, how and his statement, that very powerful quote that he gave, illustrates what needs to be changed in the military and what needs to be changed in American society, because we've become a society that doesn't take risks. Conservatives don't take risks. That's why, you know, if you start talking about the founding fathers, they get very concerned, they get very scared, like don't take away our pillars. That's what keeps us safe at night, thinking that these founding fathers knew what the hell they were doing. And if you take that away from us, you know, what it's going to be of us. And it's like, oh, this is what the system we've had all these years. Why fix what's not broken? It's broken. Look at how it is right now. It's broken. It's completely broken before you. It's as if the divine maker has just made it very clear to everybody, the system is broken. And conservatives still go, no, the safety of our founding fathers and our beloved constitution. And without realizing, no, we have to re-examine everything. It doesn't mean we have to turn to liberalism. The liberals are crazy. They don't know what they're doing. But the fact that they're crazy doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the whole system that the founding fathers left behind that needs to be transformed, so that the liberals don't get to do what they're doing right now. But no, it's too risky. You know, it's too out of the box, or too, I don't know what the word is, but it's like, oh, it doesn't sound right because there are not enough people believing this. And, you know, My father, my grandfather was a conservative, and, you know, Bible believing, and, you know, we don't think that way, you know, make America great again, you know, and that's all they can think of. And the risks, if you can call it risks, that we have to take, the changes we have to make are too unsafe for them. And that's why we are where we are. And okay, so now now that we've talked about that, I think we can more or less begin talking a little bit about Reconstruction, and we'll start talking a little bit about Lincoln and what his idea of Reconstruction was. Lincoln, you know, actually kept the real Reconstruction from starting in the territories controlled by the Union, and he did it by instituting military governors. And his idea was, okay, you know, they would take a territory, take over a territory, and, you know, like, for example, much of Tennessee was conquered back at the beginning of the war. And what Lincoln would do is, he was concerned about the radicals. That was the name of the people, the Republicans in Congress, who were fighting, were really convinced that they were a real team around the ideal of freedom for black people and a society of freedom for all people. That was their ideal. That was the team, the Republican radical team, was revolving around that ideal, and they revolved around that conviction. And Lincoln was scared to death of these people, the radicals. They were not really radicals. They were the ones who were right. But Lincoln, to them, they were a bunch of crazy risk takers. He just wanted the country to be put back together. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about slavery ending. He didn't really care about that at the end of the day. All he wanted was to bring back things to the way they were, to returning to safety. And he didn't go in, you know, when you are a radical, the way people define you, it's because you are convinced that you're going to fight for that idea, and you don't care what the consequences are. because that's the right thing to do. You don't care if you live or die. You don't care. You know, that's kind of how Menotti was approaching the game. He was saying, I'm not going to care about the result, just worrying about winning at all costs. If I win and I have to play ugly as sin to win, then I really didn't win. But ironically, when you get away from focusing on winning in that way, that's when you start really winning. That's when Argentina won their first ever World Cup in 78 with that mentality. So it's, but Lincoln didn't think like that, and he saw it as too risky to think like that. Okay, because I would be of the idea, if I'd been a radical in those days, and I were radical today, radical Republican, my idea is, okay, we're going to end slavery. And if that means destroying the country in order to end slavery, so be it. But we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to live like this anymore, because this is a violation of every moral code that we know. And as I've said before, slavery had a purpose. Slavery was supposed to exist up until a certain point, because black people had to be punished for what they were doing to themselves in Africa. And the remnant of them were brought to America. And they were made to pay a price for future generations, a price they were unwilling to pay in the African continent. They were dragged in chains and said, you're going to pay the price for future generations so that future generations can have a better life than you have. And they paid the price, and the price was supposed to end, starting to end in 1734, 35. I always forget the exact year, the year that the state of Georgia was born. And from then, there was going to be a 40-plus-year transition to end slavery, to phase out slavery until 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was made. And there might have been an additional transition from 76 to 88, 1788, when we had the Constitution ratified. And in those final 12 years, there might have been some additional transition to kind of make it official, where black people would have become fully integrated into American society as quote, regular citizens. But the thing is that before 1734, you could say there was a reason for slavery. But after 1734 or 35, please forgive me for the, not, or 1732 maybe, after that year, clearly, slavery was supposed to end, and we as a nation were violating every moral code by continuing to uphold that system, and that's what the radicals said. We are going to end this, and we are not just going to end slavery, we're going to teach the South a lesson and teach them and force them, if we have to shove it down their throats, to respect the rights of black people. And if that means that we're going to be at war for 100 years, so be it. If that means that we're going to get divided and separated forever, so be it. But to Lincoln, that was too high a risk to take. So what he started doing is he would put in military governors in those territories. And the idea is, because this is kind of like a conquered territory kind of thing, it's not really, it's kind of under military control. And that's what we were saying, which correlates with what we were saying about the military having their own judicial system, you know, the court martials and everything, where you in the military completely lose your rights. You're no longer a citizen with full rights. It's like those rights are taken away from you, and you're subject to whatever the superiors tell you to do. It's a very crooked and distorted system. It's a very dehumanizing system. And we've explained how that leads to a lot of psychological issues, because once you're kind of stripped of that, of your humanity in that sense, and you leave the system, you kind of lose yourself. You're not yourself anymore, because yourself got taken or soaked up into the military system. But the thing is, he wanted to keep those regions out of the hands of the radicals in Congress. Because if he could say, okay, this is a conquered territory, we have conquered this land, and now, Congress, you can define the laws that rule this land we have conquered. then, you know, he was afraid of doing that because that would have meant that the radicals would have started ending slavery in those territories. And he would have gone, his thinking was, oh, if these radicals start pushing anti-slavery laws in the territories we have conquered, then we're going to get all the people riled up again in those territories, and they're going to kick us out, and we're going to lose those territories. No. So he put in military governors. They were the governors, but they were military governors. They were not people appointed by Congress or who had to yield to Congress. They were their own system. You see what I'm saying? The military with their own system. So that's how he shielded those territories from the influence of the radicals, by putting in these military governors. And So Congress didn't have a say on what happened in these areas. It was up to the military governors, because it was like a war situation. You know, this is a military territory. So there's this irony that he wanted to integrate the South back as states as quickly as possible. That was his constant obsession. We want them back in the Union as quickly as possible, when the right solution was to see them as conquered territories, as a conquered, defeated foe, and to kick butt and to humiliate them until they fully accepted that slavery had to end and black people had to be treated equally. So ironically, he believed in that conquering idea, but for the purpose of preventing those territories being exposed to pressure to change. It's kind of, I don't know how to explain it. It's very ironic what this son of a bitch Lincoln did. And that's why he, for example, installed a loyalist Democrat, Andrew Johnson, as the military governor of Tennessee. We all know Andrew Johnson was a worthless son of a bitch who more than likely is burning in hell as we speak, the worthless bastard boy, son of a bitch, disgusting subhuman. This worthless bastard was put as a governor by son of a bitch Lincoln. Because he was pro-slavery, supportive of slavery, maybe not supportive in a sense, but he could live with it. He was happy with it, and he put him there. Imagine that. He wasn't forced to put Andrew Johnson. He chose Andrew Johnson and he was a Democrat. And they called him a loyalist Democrat because he was a Democrat who stayed with the Union when the Civil War broke out, but his heart was with the South, in a sense, even though he stayed with the North. Part of the Reconstruction Plan was what they called, what they did in Louisiana, which can be called like the 10% electorate plan. So in December of 1863, the son of a bitch, i.e. Lincoln, proposed a moderate plan for the reconstruction of the captured Confederate state of Louisiana. So they had conquered Louisiana by December of 1863 because of all that we've said. The Union Army was let loose. They became a team around an ideal, etc., etc. So they conquered Louisiana. And Lincoln said, okay, now that we have conquered it, let's have this plan. Let's have amnesty to rebels who take an oath of loyalty to the Union. So if you were fighting for the for the Confederates, but if you pledge to loyalty to the Union, amnesty, no punishment for you, you're done. And second, black freedmen workers tied to labor on plantations would be tied to labor on plantations for 1 year at a pay rate of $10 a month. So so you weren't instantly free. You remained tied to the labor, to work in the plantation for 1 year with a pay rate of $10 a month. And then a third element of the plan was only 10% of the state's electorate had to take the loyalty oath to readmit the state into the U.S. Congress, into the Union formally as, with representatives in Congress. 10% of the electorate, not the population, 10% of the electorate. In other words, if only one out of every 10 voters votes to support loyalty to the Union, then Louisiana can have their two senators back in the Senate, and whatever percentage of representatives in the House. So they are back to being a regular state again. Instead of using the opportunity to kind of say, okay, let's make sure before we let these sons of bitches back into the union, let's make sure that they will really end slavery and respect the rights of black people. They were conquered, for crying out loud. It's not like it was like a nil-nil draw in some sort of football match. It was like they were conquered. They were beaten 3-0, 4-0, using football terminology. They were dominated, defeated, conquered. The Union had their boots on the necks of the people of Louisiana. It was not like Louisiana was fighting back. But yet Lincoln kept saying, okay, let's just 1 out of 10. I don't care. The other 9 can be anti-black and pro-slavery and hate me and hate the Union all they want. Just 1. I just beg, please, just 1 out of 10. But there was another point in the plan. You know, the defenders of Lincoln would say, another point in the plan was the state was to abolish slavery in its new state constitution. Okay. And identical plans were adopted in Arkansas and Tennessee. So by December of 1864, the Lincoln Plan of Reconstruction had been enacted in Louisiana. So the Louisiana sent 2 senators and 5 representatives to Washington. But when they got there, Congress, the radicals, quote, in Congress, refused to count any of the votes from them, you know, from Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee. And they were basically saying, we reject your plan, Lincoln, because that was your plan. We didn't come up with that. You didn't ask us. And you decided that's the way it was going to be, and you send us these bastards who are really not repentant yet, who haven't, you know, repented of their actions, and you're sending them, now they have representatives in the Senate and representatives in the House. And so they decided, we're not going to let them, we're not going to count their votes. They can vote all they want. We're just going to ignore it. So the thing is that Congress then passed a law, the Wade-Davis law, that required that a majority, not 10%, of the state electorates take the oath of loyalty so that they can be admitted back to Congress. And even that is a little bit too soft and moderate. I know there were the radicals, but even there I can see, oh, that's a little bit moderate, because I would have been kick butt, kick butt, kick butt until they submit, and kick more butt, and kick more butt until they submit. Don't yield, don't, you know, they have to beg to be back in the Union. Like, please, please stop punishing us. Then we will, you know, we are willing to do whatever you tell us to do. I mean, that's how it had to be. But no. Well, these guys were even kind of trying to be nice. A majority have to, you know, say, you know, let's be loyal to the Union. And you know what Lincoln did when the Wade-Davis bill was passed? The son of a bitch pocket vetoed the bill. And what is a pocket veto? It's when, you know, in the current constitution, when the House passed, or when the Congress passes a bill, when it passes the House and the Senate, it goes to the president's desk. The president can sign it, then it becomes law. If he says, no, I'm not going to sign, I'm vetoing it, then it goes back to Congress, and it's not a law. If Congress votes, I think, 2/3, in favor of this bill, they can override the veto, and it becomes the law of the land. So that's the system. So when the bill came to the son of a bitch, Lincoln, he didn't veto it, because he was concerned, if I veto it, it goes back to Congress, then they can do the 2/3 vote thing and rally to get this bill passed with the majority vote, and then it's going to be the, then I'm not going to get Louisiana back into the Union, my beloved Louisiana. So he didn't veto it, but he didn't sign it either. That's what they call pocket veto. It's like he put the bill and put it in his pocket and pretended like nothing happened. So Congress couldn't act because he hadn't decided whether he was going to veto it or sign it. You see what I'm saying? And that shows another problem with the Constitution. The founding fathers, the geniuses, these geniuses the conservatives are always praising, didn't think of that scenario What happens if the president never decides to sign it or veto it? Shouldn't there, you know, it's like somebody would say, oh, you know, there's a loophole here, and we have to close this loophole. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but you know, it's over what, 150 years, I think. Yeah, over 150 years, going on 160 years, since all of this happened with the Wade Davis bill. I don't think we've ever closed that loophole, that gap. So a president, a quote president, because there are no presidents anymore, we've talked about that before, a president can pocket veto a bill again, and there's nothing in the Constitution to prevent it. I could be wrong on that, but I doubt it because I've never heard of any condition, any time limit on vetoing or not vetoing a bill. There should be a time limit. So that tells you again how bad the system is. It's a stupid system. It is so full of gaps and flaws. A lot of good intentions in it, a lot of good ideas, well, kind of a few good ideas, and a lot of good intentions. But as a system, it's just, it depends so much on the individual, on people just trying to play nice. If someone starts playing outside the boundaries of the system, they can game the system. But the thing is that so when he pocket vetoed the bill, that created that widened the rift between the moderates and the radicals. The moderates. What was a moderate back then? A guy who, or a gal who wanted to save the Union and win the war. And the radicals, quote unquote, wanted to effect a more complete change within Southern society. They just didn't want to win war. They wanted to kick butt, kick Southern butt, and force them to understand what liberty and freedom was really about, and that it applied to all people. And just as a side note, Frederick Douglass, one of the 10 greatest Americans of all time, Frederick Douglass, denounced Lincoln's 10% electorate plan, and he called it undemocratic because state admission and loyalty was only dependent on a minority vote, only 10% vote. And he said that's undemocratic. And I understand what he's saying, but I would kind of even go further than that. I don't see it as undemocratic. It's just stupid, just plain stupid. I'm not against what Lincoln was saying because it's not democratic. It's just a cowardly way of preserving the Union and sidetracking the issue of slavery. But someone would say, well, he said the state had to abolish slavery in its new state constitution. Well, let's see what happened. Louisiana did pass a state constitution that abolished slavery in 1864. But, and here's the but, and this became the but throughout Reconstruction. Everything that happened afterwards, especially after 1874. 1874 was a year of death for America. We'll talk about that later, but in another audio snippet. But this was the but throughout the whole post-Civil War period, the Reconstruction period. But that abolishment of slavery was only effective in the 13 parishes under Union control. And voting rights were only for certain blacks. Voting rights for certain blacks was allowed to be authorized but was never given. You would say, what does that mean? In other words, in the Constitution, they said, we can pass laws allowing black people to vote. And that sounds, oh, wonderful. So, but the thing is, until they pass a law allowing black people to vote, they still can't vote. So you really didn't give them anything. You see what I'm saying? It's just playing games. That's all they were doing, playing games to make it official. That they were really abolishing slavery and giving black people voting rights. And the eligible blacks that would be allowed to be authorized to vote, if a law, such a law was passed, were people of blacks who fought for the Union or owned property or were illiterate. So you had to be one of those three: fighting for the Union, owned property, or be literate. And so it wasn't like, you know, any person, no matter the color, will be allowed to vote under the same criteria. You know, they put a separate list of criteria for black people. And there were other non-whites that were excluded from voting in this wonderful constitution. And this constitution established a free public school system for all children ages 6 to 18. You say, oh, that's wonderful. There's a lot to say about the public education system. That's for another audio snippet. But I guess on principle, you could say that's a good idea, and it sounds wonderful. But turns out the legislature, so it said there's gonna be free public school system for all children, no matter the race, from 6 to 18. But in practice, the legislature only established schools for whites. So in other words, it was always everything was on paper just to get past the technicality, so that they could say, yeah, we complied. But at heart, they would just keep doing their own thing. So when Lincoln would say, oh yeah, but I'm demanding the Constitution, the state pass a constitution that abolishes slavery. But yeah, they would just pass something in writing and just put things and say, we are going to allow future legislatures to pass laws allowing black people to vote. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. It's not going to be against the Constitution to allow black people to vote. But they're still not allowing them to vote. See what I'm saying? It's just words. And we're going to abolish slavery, but only in the territories controlled by the Union. Why? Because they had no choice. They had no choice. The Union Army was controlling those parishes. They had no choice but to let the slaves go, because the Union Army was on their tail, constantly forcing them to let the slaves be free. What other choice they had, but they didn't say it's going to be abolished throughout the whole state of Louisiana, just in the parishes that are currently controlled by the Union Army. But okay, we abided by the technicality. We have complied with the technicality. Now we're going to send our representatives to Washington. So this is the idiot that people call the greatest president of all time, this son of a bitch Lincoln. This is what he was doing. And I'm not making this up. This is not conspiracy theory. This is not revisionist history. This is exactly what was going on. But this is all backed up by documents, by historical records, by everything. The radical Republicans were very upset with Lincoln because Lincoln was dragging his feet, because he was always avoiding taking risks. And he didn't win the war. We won the war despite the son of a bitch Lincoln, not because of him. Because he kept dragging his feet in doing what was right. And that's why he got shot in the head. And thank God he got shot in the head. Worthless bastard. Be gone. Out of the way. He deserved that shot in the head. He earned it by his stupidity. And because of his foot dragging, we went down a road that lasted 100 years of utter... of so many things that we went through that we would not have gone through had he done things right. He had the historic opportunity to transform things, to transform the future, and he chose not to because he wanted to play safe. That's why I despise him. He's not even in the top 100 greatest Americans of all time, not even in the top million. Stupid idiot, a worthless son of a bitch. And, okay, so now that we've talked a little bit about that son of a bitch, we will talk in a future audio snippet about the son of a bitch that followed him. The one that he picked as his vice president. He proudly picked him as his vice president. And we'll talk about, you know, we'll briefly mention why he did that. But we'll talk about it, him, and talk about this, the evil that he did and what the radicals, Republicans, tried to do to counter him and counter the recalcitrant South, but to no avail at the end of the day. But we'll talk about all of that in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.